from the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew introducing The Beatles Story. I'm a pieces, bits and pieces. The so-called Tottenham sound of the Dave Clark Five. Their first record, Glad All Over, had replaced the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand, and now Bits and Pieces was smashing its way up the charts. Was this the sound to replace the Mersey Beat in 1964? The Beatles were in Paris, appearing at the Olympia Theatre, when news came through that I Want to Hold Your Hand had reached the number one spot in the American Top 100, followed by She Loves You, Please Please Me, and From Me to You. This was the breakthrough they'd been hoping for. Part 5, The World Surrenders. Brian Epstein had obviously been interested in getting the Beatles launched in America for some time. One of the people responsible for their appearance in New York was promoter Sid Bernstein.
I started to read some things about the Beatles and Beatlemania long before I'd even heard a record of theirs or even read much in our trade press. And I decided that if Beatlemania had touched England, it was inevitable that it would touch our shores. And so I did 3 weeks of exploratory work and found this young man that I'd been reading about, who was their manager, found Brian Epstein's home number. And I got him at home. And this was the summer of 63. Really early in the Beatles' development, or at least in their famous stage of development. We made a deal on the phone for $6,500 for two shows.
Now, this sounded like a good deal to Brian, but a national television show would ensure that an even wider public were aware of the Beatles. Ed Sullivan.
For years, we've visited London, so on one of our arrivals in late 1963 at London Airport, when Mrs. Sullivan and I saw hundreds and hundreds of youngsters, I asked what celebrity was arriving. And they told us the teenagers were awaiting the Beatles. Always on the lookout for talent, I decided the Beatles would be a good TV attraction for our show. So I contacted Brian Epstein, their manager, and we agreed on $10,000 for three shows, plus five round-trip plane tickets, plus their expenses for room and board in New York City.
With the TV shows set, plus the concerts, it was time to cross the pond for the USA. On February the 7th, 1964, 4,000 Beatle fans turned up at Heathrow Airport to wave goodbye to Pan Am flight number 101. One member of the press corps waiting for the Beatles at the airport in New York was Al Aronowitz.
Four was wondering out loud how they would be greeted in America. Wondering why should America want the Beatles when America had so much of its own. And of course, as the plane came in and they saw that mob, they knew they were all right. The mob was literally bulging on the observation roof. I was working for the Saturday Evening Post at that time. And actually, there hadn't been so much press coverage of an event since Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, you know, or the Kennedy assassination, for that matter.
With them on the plane was Phil Spector, whom they'd met during his visit to Great Britain with the Ronettes. As the Beatles came off the plane, they were greeted by the screams of thousands of fans and a barrage of flashbulbs from a flock of photographers present. And, of course, there were the TV and radio men waiting for a few Beatle words. One of New York's top DJs at that time was Murray the K.
I was the anchor man to try to get an interview in that horde of newspaper and radio and television people. Do-da, do-da. And they came in, and they started rapping with the reporters, and I was wearing one of my straw hats in the middle of winter or something, I forget. And I remember we were in the front row at the time, the radio people. And George turned to me and said, "Hey, I dig your hat." And I said, "Yeah, great." I said, "I hear you came over with a friend of mine. Some friends of mine, the Ronettes and Phil Spector." Said, "Yeah, who are you?" I said, "I'm Murray the K." So George says, "Hey, this is Murray the K." And all the fellas started coming over to, start a rap. And there I was with the cameras whirling, standing there just rapping. I forgot that my mic was on. And on the CBS network at the time, they were live on television. And they said, "Hey, tell Murray the K to cut that crap out." So that was my introduction to the Beatles.
John and Paul combining for the very punchy vocal on Tell Me Why. The radio stations had done the boys proud. WMCA in New York even gave a commentary on the flight over, giving time checks in Beatle time and temperature in Beatle degrees. George Harrison describes what happened at the press conference.
They started asking us all funny questions, so we just started answering them with stupid answers.
Actually, George is being somewhat modest there. To try and give you the flavour of those early press conferences in America, here are some of the boys' answers to the correspondents' questions. First, they were asked if Beatlemania embarrassed them.
"No, it's great. We like lunatics. Yeah. It's healthy."
"Will you sing us a song?"
"No."
"Sorry.
Next question.
No, we need money first.
How much money do you expect to take out of this country?
Oh, about half a crown, $2. Depends on the tax.
Are you for Elvis Presley's?
He must be blind.
It's not true.
Do you ever have haircuts?
No.
I had one yesterday. And that's no lie.
That's the truth.
Honest, that's it.
No, I think he missed.
No. No, he didn't, no.
You should have seen him the day before.
Okay, come on here.
How do you account for your success?
If we knew, we'd form another group and be managers.
Why do you sing like Americans and speak like Englishmen?
That is English, actually.
It's not English, it's Liverpudlian, you see.
Well, the Liverpool accent, so the way you say some of the words. No, you say grass instead of grass.
Grass?
Well, that sounds a bit American. So there you go. Liverpool.
Anyway, it sells better.
The capital.
What do you think of Beethoven?
Great. Especially his poems.
When are you going to retire?
Next week.
I don't know.
No, probably
no. We're going to keep going as long as we can.
When we get fed up with it, you know, we're still enjoying it now.
Any minute now.
No, as long as we enjoy it, we'll do it. Because we enjoyed it before we made any money.
And that's the way it used to go. And they clearly enjoyed those press conferences too, in the beginning, anyway. We asked Murray the K just how he used to introduce the Beatles on the air in those days.
I used to do things like... Okay, we got a man. 1, 2, 3, and 4. 4 Beatles in a row gonna sing for you. Right now, George does the lead. Dig it.
Before this dance is through, I think I love you too. I'm so happy when you dance with me. I don't wanna kiss or hold your hand. If it's funny, try and understand. Cause I'm happy just to dance with you. I don't need to hug or hold you tight. I just want to dance with you all night. In this world there's nothing I would rather do. Cause I'm happy just to dance with you. Just to dance with you is everything I need. Before this dance is through, I think I'll love you too. I'm so happy when you dance with me. If somebody tries to take my place, let's pretend we just can't see his face. In this world there's nothing I would rather do. Cause I'm happy just to dance with you. Just to dance with you. Oh, is everything I need. I think I love you too. I'm so happy when you dance with me. If somebody tries to take my place, let's pretend we just can't see his face. In this world there's nothing I would rather do. I've discovered I'm in love with you. Cause I'm happy just to dance with you.
As Murray the K told us, George Harrison singing there. As a matter of fact, soon after the Beatles had checked into New York's Eminent Plaza Hotel, George was decidedly unwell and had to miss the rehearsal for the Ed Sullivan Show. But he got there in time for the transmission. The demand for tickets was incredible. Nearly 100 people applied for every seat available to the studio audience. The show itself, well, here's the other George Harrison of the Liverpool Echo who accompanied them on that visit.
Later, I saw Ed, and he told me the first show that they did, we had an audience for that show of 73 million people, right the way throughout the United States. And the police claimed that that was the one night of the whole year that they had fewer hubcaps stolen than they'd ever had before in history.
The timing of this visit ensured their conquest of America. In Brian Epstein's own words...
Going over at that particular moment for those two Ed Sullivan shows could not have been more right. The records were just at the top. They'd been at the top for a couple of weeks and they were still at the top. And it fitted in very well indeed.
I've got something to say that might cause you pain. If I catch you talking to that boy again, I'm gonna let you down and leave you flat. tell you one more time, I think you're just it. I think I let you down.
That. The next day, February the 12th, the Beatles were due back in New York to appear at Sid Bernstein's promotion in the Carnegie Hall.
The governor's wife, Mrs. Rockefeller, managed to buy three. She had four in a party, three children and herself. I gave up my own seat to Mrs. Nelson Rockefeller so she could sit with her three children. I brought her little girl, a pretty little blonde girl who must now be an attractive young lady. I can't remember her name. I brought her up to see the Beatles at that dressing room in Carnegie, and she came back, "Mother, mother, I'm just so thrilled." I remember that incident. It was one of the great days of my life. It was the Beatles' first visit to America.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me, somehow I will know. Someday when I'm lonely, wishing you weren't so far away, then I will remember things we said today. You say you'll be my girl till the end of time. These days such a kind girl seems so hard to find. Someday when we're dreaming, deep in love, not a lot to say, then we will remember things we said today. Me, I'm just the lucky kind, love to hear you say that love is love, and though we blind. Love is here to stay, and that's enough to make you mine, girl. Be the only one. Love me all the time, girl. We'll go on and on. Someday when we're dreaming, deep in love, not a lot to say, then we will remember things we said today. Me, I'm just the lucky kind, love to hear you say that love is love, and though we may be blind, love is here to stay, and that's enough to make you mine, girl. Be the only one, love me all the time, girl. We'll go on and on. Someday when we're dreaming, deep in love, not a lot to
to say, then we will remember things we said today.
A lead vocal from Paul. They appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show again 4 days later, and by this time there was no doubt that America was Beatle crazy. From New York, the boys went down to Miami for another appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, and then a short holiday. On February the 22nd, 1964, the Beatles arrived back at London Airport. BBC reporter Hugh Moran was there. So were 6,000 fans.
Here come the Beatles themselves, waving. The crowd are really going frenziedly mad now. Four of them are here. First down the steps is Paul McCartney, followed by Ringo. After Ringo, John. After John, George. There they are, all four of them, standing on the steps now, all wearing dark overcoats, white shirts, neckties, looking very smart, and almost very American, dare I say it. They're waving. The flash bells are popping, the cameras are whirring. The Beatles, the beloved Beatles from Merseyside, are back in this country.
Even back in Great Britain, the Beatles had to face another press conference.
George, the fans obviously enjoyed it over there. I assume the press enjoyed it. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was marvellous. Yeah, everything. Every bit of it was knocked out.
Even the work?
Yeah, we enjoyed it. You know, it was different. Yeah. You know, working in different places with the audience all around us and... You know, it was a novelty.
What impressed you most about the place? You have time to take anything in properly?
Yeah. I don't know. I enjoyed the sun in Miami most of all. You know, healthy.
You're the healthy one.
But the sun was sort of
very healthy.
Yeah, very healthy.
Did you have a chance to get away from anybody at any time on the trip?
Yeah.
You got away from me twice.
What did you most like about the trip, Ringo?
Oh, I just loved all of it, you know, especially Miami. The sun, you know. I didn't know what it meant until I went over there.
Don't you get it up in Liverpool?
No, they finished up there, you know. Cut it out.
Did you ever have a chance, John, to just get away on your own without anybody recognising you?
We borrowed a couple of millionaires' houses, you know.
Well,
we did.
You could afford to buy a couple of millionaires' houses, couldn't you?
No, John. We'd sooner borrow them, it's cheaper.
And so the good-natured repartee continued, until at last the Beatles were allowed to escape to anonymity in London. A few days later, February the 25th, George celebrated his 21st birthday. And in early March, they started work on their first feature film, A Hard Day's Night. The producer was Walter Shenson, and the director was Dick Lester. Dick suggested that Alan Owen should write the script.
Alan, Walter and I went to Paris, where the Beatles were doing an Olympia concert at the beginning of 64 with Sylvie Vartan. We watched them in their hotel room in the George Sank, behaving in a way which was extraordinary. In other words, they were prisoners. They had come to Paris. I believe none of them had ever been to Paris before. They saw the car that took them there. They saw the backstage of the Olympia, and they went to their hotel room and stayed there, and sandwiches were brought up. And in essence, a screenplay began to form in our minds because we were watching it happen. And since we had already decided we wanted to make a documentary film, or a film which was a fictionalized documentary, all we were doing was just trying to keep our eyes open.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands. If I give my heart to you, I must be sure from the very start that you would love me more than her. If I trust in you, oh please, don't run and hide. If I love you too, oh please, don't hurt my pride like her. 'Cause I could sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see that
couldn't stand the pain, and I would be sad if our new love was in vain. So I hope you see that I would love to love you, and that she will cry when she learns we are two. If I fell in love with you,
a lot of people's favourite Beatle ballad with John and Paul in harmony. Now, at this stage, the film they were working on didn't have a title, and it was Ringo who provided this. How?
I don't know. It just came out. We went to do a job, you know, and we worked all day, and we happened to work all night, and I came out still thinking it was day, I suppose, and said, it's been a hard day. Looked around, it was dark, and said, night. And so we came to a hard day's night.
And that was John, who showed another facet of his talent in March when his first book was published. Called In His Own Right, it comprised a lot of John's early jottings from Merseybeat magazine with some more recent material, and it went to the top of the bestseller lists. John was guest of honour at a Foyle's literary luncheon. Helen Shapiro was there too.
I was sitting about three seats away from John, and everybody's making grand speeches, a lot of very important-looking people, very dignified, and some made funny speech. I think Wilfred Bramble was there as well. He made a speech. And then it was time for John to get up and say his piece, and now, of course, the man we've honoured here today, he's going to speak to us. Big hand for John Lennon. Rousing applause. He stood up and said...
Thank you all very much. God bless you.
And sat down again, and that was it, and sort of eyebrows shot up. Nobody said anything at the time, but I remember in the papers there was a whole thing about it.
And round about the same time, on March the 20th, the Beatles issued a new single, their first since November.
Can buy me love, love, buy me love.
Can't Buy Me Love was written really when we were in Paris, yeah.
We had to have a new record ready for recording in England, and we were going to record a song in Paris as well. So we wrote Can't Buy Me Love there, and we recorded the first track of it in Paris, and we finished it off in London. So it's two-country effort. It's double-tracked, you know.
Can't buy me love. Makes you feel alright. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel alright. Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. Just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love.
Days after release, Can't Buy Me Love was number one in the British charts, the Beatles' fifth consecutive number one record. During April and May, the Beatles continued filming A Hard Day's Night. And in June, they spent a couple of days in Denmark doing concerts as a sort of warm-up for a Far Eastern tour that was to follow on June the 8th. Ringo wasn't able to go to Denmark, or initially to the Far East, as he had tonsillitis, and this caused problems. Producer George Martin.
John and Paul readily agreed that it was a sensible thing to do to get a replacement. George Harrison was a little more difficult. In fact, he was downright truculent. He said, if Ringo's not going, then neither am I. He said, you can find two replacements. And Brian and I had quite a difficult time persuading him that it was in the interest of the group as a whole for him to go and put up with Jimmy Nicol, who was the drummer we used. And so it went off quite all right, apparently. It wasn't too bad. Ringo stayed at home. And the group was a success, even without him.
I got every reason on earth to be mad, 'cause I just lost the only girl I had. If I could get my way, I'd get myself locked up today, but I can't, so I drive instead. I got a chip on my shoulder that's bigger than my feet. If I could see it now, I'd try to make you sad somehow, but I can't, so I'll cry instead. Don't wanna cry when there's people there, I get shy when they start to stare. I'm gonna lie myself away, hey, but I'll come back again someday. I'm gonna do you better, hide all the girls. I'm gonna break their hearts. Show you what your loving man can do. Until then, I'll cry instead. Don't wanna cry when there's people there. I get shy when they start to stare. I'm gonna hide myself away, hey, but I'll come back again someday. And when I do, you better hide all the girls, 'cause I'm gonna break their hearts all around the world. Yes, I'm gonna break them in two.
you what your loving man can do. Until then, I'll cry instead.
John and Paul duetting again. The reaction to their visit to Hong Kong, New Zealand and Australia was, if anything, bigger than it had been in America. Back in England, there was the music to finish for A Hard Day's Night. George Martin.
I did all the background scoring and the arranging of music for the film and the planning of the title and so on. And it all had to be done terribly quickly, of course. And it worked out quite well. In fact, I was very lucky and I got an Academy Award nomination for it, which was really terribly unjust because it was really basically the boys' work.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too. I love her. She gives me everything and tenderly. The kiss my lover brings, she brings to me. And I love her. A love like ours could never die, as long as I have you near me. Bright are the stars that shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine die, and I love her. Stars that shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her.
A solo there from Paul. With some apprehension, Dick Lester arranged to show a first print of the finished film to some film company executives and their wives.
And I sat behind a lady who I'd never met, who was the wife of one of the executives, and we sat there hugging our sides in terror. And the film started, and of course there were only about 15 people there, and it was playing around a bit, about the first 8 minutes, and I suddenly heard this woman go, I thought, oh God. Made a quick mental note, we can always tighten that scene up, it'll be all right, I think. And about 3 minutes later, she went, I thought, well, I suppose that scene could come out and we could just go directly to the hotel scene. That's, get rid of that. No, perspire freely. Or about 40 more times to speed up the story, this woman went, by the end, I was convinced, you know, that was it. It was the last film I would ever make. And my God, it's just as well we're getting it out quickly so we can get out of the country. And the lights went up and nobody said anything. And this woman turned around and looked at me and said, oh, Mr. Lester, what a film. And I collapsed.
The lady's comment proved to be right. And the film had a royal premiere in London on July the 6th with Princess Margaret and Lord Snowden in attendance. George Martin again.
In Hard Day's Night itself, we wanted a particularly strident beginning. And there's that guitar chord, which was very, you know, you identify it straight away as being A Hard Day's Night. And that was the beginning of the picture. And that we thought was a good start off. But from their point of view, it was just like making an ordinary gramophone record. The fitting part came later when, having made the records, they then did, in fact, mime to the discs on the set. But there wasn't much of that going on because Dick, quite cleverly, I think, purposely went out of his way not to do miming, so that you got perhaps the boys in one sequence starting off miming, But then suddenly, without any apparent reason, they would suddenly switch to be playing cards, and you would hear their voices going, but their lips wouldn't be moving. And that worked, you know, it was a good style.
As for the filming itself, Paul had a comment.
We're not really actors, you know, we're first of all singers, and then sort of musicians of sorts, but last of all we're actors, you know, so we didn't really know how to act. But lots of people on the film helped us with it. The real actors, you know, like Wilfred Bramwell and Norman Rossington, who were in the film, helped us with it and told us one or two things to do. I just hope that people like this film and look forward to the next one, like we do.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing, and it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why on earth should I moan? 'Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright.
Finally, to round off the film's success, the Beatles attended a charity premiere and civic reception in Liverpool. How they came to enjoy that success and some of its rewards, you can hear in the next episode of The Beatles Story. The Beatles Story was written and produced for the BBC by Johnny Beerley.